It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. You know, we've addressed the politics of Antonin Scalia's death and picking his replacement several times this week, last week, on Iowa Public Radio and NPR. This hour, we want to steer clear of the politics of this issue as much as possible. That may not be entirely possible. And instead, look at how this political standoff may affect work at our nation's highest court. In a few minutes, we'll dive into some of the most significant cases before the U.S. Supreme Court this session. But first, news today. The White House is considering picking the Republican governor from Nevada to fill the current vacancy on the Supreme Court, Brian Sandoval. He's a centrist, former federal judge who has served as governor of Nevada since 2011. And Senate Republicans have pledged to play the role of roadblock. They've promised not to consider any nomination before November's elections, even after news of Sandoval's consideration broke. GOP leaders still insisted that Obama nominating a Republican would make no difference. We want to jump to this news item before we get to cases before the Supreme Court with our legal expertise. Todd Pettis is professor of law and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa, joining us in our Iowa City studio. Welcome back to our program, Todd.
Thanks very much for the invitation, Ben.
And Tony Goggin is with us, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University in Des Moines, in our Des Moines studio. Tony, great to have you back on.
Ben, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
As I said, before we get to the cases, and there are plenty of interesting cases for you to reel out and analyze for us before the Supreme Court, let's talk about the news that we've been dealing with the last few days. What I just mentioned there, the Republican governor said to be perhaps one of the people Obama is considering. Let me ask you this, Todd Pettis. Comment on that latest news in the context of the type of appointees presidents tend to pick. What kind of resume are they looking for?
Well, the resume they look for in an ordinary year is not necessarily the resume that President Obama is looking for right now. You know, in an ordinary year, a president is looking to maximize his legacy, looking for an appointment, someone who will be there for decades and kind of continue to carry out that president's own understanding of the political world and the constitutional world. And President Obama knows that he's not going to have nearly as free a hand as he might have had were this not an election year. And so, you know, he's looking for someone who's going to maximize political advantage for the Democrats, of course. Someone who would be very painful for the Republicans to turn down, someone that would place Republican senators in jeopardy if they were to resist, someone who's moderate enough that President Obama would be proud of that justice in future years. And that's a tough pick. And someone like Governor Sandoval is a, you know, I don't know a lot about his, about him, like many in the country. I've been learning more about him in the last couple of days. But, you know, on the face of it, he is a plausible person to fit that bill. He's a moderate. He was confirmed by a unanimous vote, or 89-0, all senators who participated in the vote to put him on the bench as a federal judge a while back. There, he had no opposition at all. And so that makes it more difficult for Republicans, many of them who were in the Senate at the time, to say, well, we were fine for putting him on a district court. There's no opposition. He sailed through. But now we're not even going to do so much as give him a hearing.
Mm-hmm. So, Tony, let me ask you this. So this will be a departure when we consider President Obama's two previous appointees to the high court, Kagan and Sotomayor. Do you agree with Todd that this is an entirely different context than we had for those first nominees?
Yes, Ben, I absolutely agree with Todd. We're really in unique historical territory right now because of the fact that the Senate Republicans are threatening not to give the president's nominee a hearing or even a vote. So this really is a unique situation. And I think just the fact that the president's considering not only a Republican but an office holder is historic. We haven't had anyone who had political experience as an elected official appointed to the court since Sandra Day O'Connor in the early 1980s. So for a couple of different reasons, I think this really is potentially a historic move by the president, mm-hmm. if he makes it.
How long, Tony, does it typically take for a nominee to work his or her way through the Senate confirmation process?
Well, in the last half century, the process has lasted on average in the neighborhood of 45 to 60 days. We've been running a little bit longer in recent years, but basically it's usually around 2 months. I think Louis Brandeis had to spend a total of about 120 days between his nomination and his confirmation. But that is definitely on the long end, historically speaking. Normally, it's about 2 months.
Mm-hmm. So if we think about how many days the president is in office, there are days of plenty to get this job done when we think about, what, some 300 days left of the Obama presidency. If the Senate Republicans – let me point this to you, Todd Pettis – succeed in blocking any nominee until the next president is sworn in, which would be January of 2017 – what's the earliest our U.S. Supreme Court would operate again with nine justices?
Well, by Tony's math, which I agree is the right math, I think we're looking at March, April, something like that, of 2017.
Is there any precedent for that type of delay, an even number of justices for that length of time?
Precedent for an even number of justices, I don't think, and Tony can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think there's any precedent for a delay that where politics are playing a role in keeping a seat vacant for that duration. Do you know of any contrary instances, Tony?
No, I agree with you, Todd. This really would be unprecedented. We have had periods where there's been a vacant seat on the court for many, many months, but you really have to go back to the 19th century to see anything that would be comparable to this.
Civil War era?
Even before the Civil War, the president who had the least amount of success when it came to Supreme Court nominations was John Tyler. He's also known to history as his accidency. He was the vice president under William Henry Harrison, who very tragically died in his first year in office, in fact, his first month in office. And so Tyler was a very weak president dealing with a hostile Congress, and he had a number of nominations shot down. But that's so far in the past, I really don't think that's much of a historical precedent for where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, this whole political debate, our U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley at the heart of it as the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And this week, Senator Harry Reid, the minority leader in the Senate, warned that Grassley would go down as, quote, the most obstructionist Senate Judiciary Committee chairman in history for denying to hear a Supreme Court nominee for President Obama. Now, let's just pull apart the politics, because a lot is being spun this way and that way, we've heard this week. The Constitution, correct me if I'm wrong, says Supreme Court justices are nominated by the president with advice and consent of the Senate. Now, Senator Grassley interprets this clause as also including the ability to not decide to advise and consent. Todd Pettis, how firm is that legal footing for that interpretation?
I think that the truth is, at the end of the day, that the Constitution leaves the answer to this question largely to politics, maybe in equal measure to politics and also to historical practices, insofar as those historical practices are an indicator of what the Constitution itself means. But Vice President Biden, being widely quoted now, is what he said in 1992 when the shoe was on the other foot. By saying that the Senate plays the role of advising and consenting, one way to read that is to say that no one gets on the bench without the Senate's agreement. It does not impose an affirmative obligation on the Senate to crank up its hearing machinery and actually take a vote. People are in the legal world are of two minds about what the best understanding of the Constitution is, but we're never going to get a definitive answer to the question. The Supreme Court is never going to answer that question, in my view. They're going to call it a political question, which is a plain English term, but it's also mm-hmm. a technical legal term. I think probably this is something for the political branches to work out. And so Senator Grassley can take his position. Vice President Biden can take the position he took in 1992. They can switch. If in 4 years or 8 years we have a Republican facing a vacancy, and if the Democrats control the Senate, I don't have any doubt whatsoever that the parties will flip, and they'll then quote each other for what they're saying in this round, and on life will go. And the reason it will go on that way is because there's no way that we can come up with a definitive legal answer that pushes politics aside and says, everyone, you have to do it this way.
Tony, is that your read of this as well?
I agree with Todd, absolutely. Indeed, with virtually every single person involved in this right now, including Senator Grassley, President Obama, Senator McConnell, and the Vice President, you can find quotes from 10 or 20 years ago where they took the exact opposite position of what they're taking right now. So clearly, neither side has a lot of credibility as far as intellectual consistency on this issue. But I would say that if the Senate does not provide an up or down vote to the nominee, whoever the nominee is, it really would be taking things too far, in my view at least. I think it would be setting a dangerous precedent.
Dangerous how?
Dangerous in that, you know, as law professors, we often like to use slippery slope arguments just for sort of devil's advocate purposes. But this is one case where I do think we're in an escalating cycle of political polarization and obstructionist tactics by both sides. But at some point, cooler heads have to prevail, and we have to preserve the institutional, you know, good, decent functioning of the Supreme Court and the nominating process. And my concern would be if there is no vote granted to whoever the nominee is this year, I can easily imagine a scenario where a future Senate will argue that there should not be a nomination made during a midterm election year.
Right.
And then we would essentially have rewritten the Constitution to say you can only nominate someone to the Supreme Court 2 of every 4 years.
Right, right. So you can continue, you can keep moving this back day by day. Now it happened to be in what, February that we had a justice die, but what if he had died in January or December or November?
Yeah, that's right. If you look at the letter that the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee released, we already see this line drawing happening. If you pull that up online and take a look at it, they're saying, you know, it hasn't been since 1932 that we've had both a vacancy and a nomination to fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court since then. Well, we have had instances where there is a vacancy in the year prior to an election year and then a confirmation vote in the presidential election year. But Tony's exactly right. If we do set this historical precedent, there's no principled reason for drawing the lines anywhere in a fixed way. There's no way to cabin this. And so pretty soon we say, well, what's the difference between a vacancy that happens in December before an election year on December 20th versus one that happens on January 2nd. There's no constitutional reason to draw the line there. And so we're deciding as a country through our politicians, I think, right now about what we want the precedent to be and how far, as Tony puts it, how much more do we want to escalate the partisanship?
Mm-hmm. Can you have – and maybe I read, Tony, your comment wrong here. Can you have a vote without going through the proceedings, the hearings in the committee and then put it to the Senate for a larger vote?
Well, it's up to the Senate to decide their rules. So under the current rules, there will be a hearing and then a vote. I was just focusing on the most important part from my point of view, which is the vote. But I would be stunned if they were to have a vote without hearings, because the hearings are an important fact-binding part of the process. But the most important duty of the Senate is to actually vote up or down on a nominee. Again, just as Todd said earlier, there is no express constitutional mandate that the Senate provide a vote because the term is consent, as Todd said. But I think a commonsensical reading of consent would include voting up or down on the nomination.
Tony Goggin is with us, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University. Todd Pettis, Professor of Law at the University of Iowa College of Law, and we're obviously talking about the latest news filling Scalia's, Antonin Scalia's death, filling that vacancy on our high court. We like to a couple times a year look at what's on the docket of the U.S. Supreme Court. That's what we're doing here, and we want to get to cases because it will be clear as we get into some of these cases. The other question here is how a Supreme Court operates with an even number of justices. It has 8, and in fact, it has 4 conservatives, 4 more liberal justices. So we'll see as we go through these cases what problems that presents. Todd Pettis, let's have you take us through one of the cases that you pointed out was a major abortion case out of Texas that concerns the meaning of undue burden, a test that the court adopted 20 years ago. Tell us about this case.
This is an interesting case in many different ways, and it's of particular interest to us here in Iowa for reasons that Al explained. But first, just from the national perspective, this is the first significant abortion rights case that the court has taken in about a decade, and I think it has the potential, depending on what the court says, to be the most significant abortion case since 1992's Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which is where you referenced that phrase undue burden. It's where the current legal framework for analyzing abortion rights was set out. And in order to understand this case, kind of just think historically about legislative efforts to restrict abortion. The first wave of legislative efforts to cut back on abortion were really focused on trying to protect the fetus. And so we had restrictions about, you know, how many weeks into the pregnancy do we go before we draw a line and say no abortions after this point. Here in Iowa, we had at one time a rule that a law that banned telemedicine abortions, you know, where the doctor remotely, they're on video and they provide access to a locked drawer that contains a pill that will terminate a pregnancy. Well, we're moving into that wave now that looks like that what we had here in Iowa. We're focusing not so much on the health of the fetus, how many weeks into the pregnancy are we, but as we were trying to do here in Iowa as the Iowa Board of Medicine, adopting laws at least purportedly to protect the woman for her benefit, for her health. And that's really the second wave of abortion restrictions that we're seeing around the country, ones that at least in name are trying to protect the woman. And it, you might recall Wendy Davis's. She's a senator from Texas. She had a famous filibuster where she was trying to block some abortion legislation going through Texas. Well, it's that statute. The law that she was fighting is the statute that's in front of the Supreme Court right now.
Which says what in Texas?
And that law says that in order to perform abortions, you must be a doctor who has admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles so that if something goes wrong during the procedure, you can get that woman checked in at a nearby hospital. And it also says that the clinic has to be equipped in various sophisticated ways that many of them are not currently equipped now. And Texas says we're doing this for the health of the woman. Okay. Well, the fight is what does a state, if anything, does a state need to show when defending these laws? Does a state have to show that when it restricts access to abortion in the name of protecting the health of the woman, does the state carry any burden at all to show that, in fact, they are advancing women's health? The Iowa Supreme Court, a couple years ago, when it had the telemedicine abortion case in front of it, the Iowa Supreme Court struck that rule down and said, as we understand Planned Parenthood versus Casey, this earlier federal Supreme Court case, as we understand the precedent, Iowa needs to show that this ban on telemedicine abortion is actually making women safer. The state can't prove that, and so this is an unjustified obstacle in the path of the woman who wants to terminate the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. That Iowa Supreme Court ruling is front and center in this Texas litigation. One of the things, chief things that the parties are arguing about is whether the Iowa Supreme Court got it right. And the United States Supreme Court, is the justices are going to make a judgment about that. Is the approach that the Iowa Supreme Court take, is that the right path? And so, and again, that path is if we make the state show that if they say they're trying to protect the woman's health, we need to empirically see that, in fact, that's the effect of the law. Otherwise, it's just an unjustified obstacle. Mm-hmm. Texas's view is it's wrong for the courts to engage in that kind of second guessing. All we want to know is, how, is it making it really difficult, substantially harder for the woman to obtain an abortion? If it's not, then the law stands.
Mm-hmm. Has this case been heard yet?
No, it's heard next week, Wednesday, March 2nd.
So we can't speculate based on the questions of the justices whether this – is this one likely to be affected by the 4-4 makeup of our current court, even number?
Yes. We're not going to get – I'm confident we're not going to get five justices adopting a narrow reading of abortion rights. I think we're going to get either a 4-4 ruling where the justices split, or we're going to get a 5-3 ruling endorsing the approach taken by the Iowa Supreme Court. I don't think we're going to get a majority ruling rejecting the approach taken by the Iowa Supreme Court favoring the approach that Texas is taking.
In the case of a 4-4 split, it is the lower court that decision stands?
That's right. And so we end up with disparity around the country. If we have a 4-4 split, what that means is that women in Iowa will have greater abortion rights than women in Texas will, because the Iowa Supreme Court has read Iowa law one way. The federal court that oversees federal law in Texas, they've read it a different way, and so we'll have disparity in abortion rights.
Okay, we'll have to watch that. Todd Pettis, we've got three or so minutes before we go to break. I wonder if we can get in another health care case or several cases before the Supreme Court regarding the Affordable Care Act and religious freedom.
Yeah, this is the follow-up to the Hobby Lobby ruling, which many I'm sure will recognize it by that name. That's the case that said that Hobby Lobby – as a closely held corporation, has religious freedom rights under a piece of federal legislation called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And the fight there was about access to contraception. Hobby Lobby said that there are certain forms of contraception, like IUDs or morning after pills, that are really tantamount to abortion. They prevent a pregnancy from proceeding. They say that's just like abortion. We oppose it. And in the Hobby Lobby case, the court said Hobby Lobby does have religious freedom rights, and those rights prevail here. Now, in the course of saying that Hobby Lobby's rights prevail, they pointed to a so-called accommodation that religious nonprofit organizations like, for example, Little Sisters of the Poor or Priests for Life, religious organizations that carry out in a nonprofit way, carry out various advocacy and educational and medical and so forth objectives. The law at the time that Hobby Lobby came down said that if you're a religious nonprofit, you don't have to provide your employees with insurance that gives them access to contraception in this way. All you have to do is notify your insurance company that you don't want to be a part of that, and then the burden will be on the insurance company to provide access to contraception. The issue in front of the court now is whether that is itself a violation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Okay, and so we have religious nonprofits and others too who want, you know, this accommodation that the Supreme Court previously in Hobby Lobby pointed to as a one way that we could arrange things that wouldn't impinge so heavily on Hobby Lobby's religious freedom rights. Is that accommodation itself a violation of the statute?
And before we go to break, very quickly, also one that will be affected perhaps by the even number of justices in the court?
Yes. Again, 4-4 is likely, or possibly a 5-3, maybe 6-2. But I think the 4-5 is about as high as they'll go, reading the statute in a way that, in fact, there is no violation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
So again, we'll have an uneven – it will be state by state whether this accommodation is offered or not.
That's right. Here in the Eighth Circuit, our Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals for this region of the country has said that this accommodation does, in fact, violate the statute. Religious telling nonprofits they have to do this is a violation.
Okay. Todd Pettis, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. Tony Goggin with us, associate professor of law at Drake University. We're going through some of the most significant cases before the high court. Of course, talking about the politics of the high court as it affects the operations of the high court, how it functions with eight members. When we come back, we'll turn to Tony to have us tell us about the United States v. Texas. That's an immigration case concerning President Obama's authority on immigration. And we'll continue in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa, Tony Goggin of Drake University, law professors, and we're picking apart some of the most significant cases before the high court, the U.S. Supreme Court, also considering the death of Antonin Scalia and the fight over his replacement. We're talking about how that impacts the work of the court. Before we do get back to more cases, Tony telling us about an immigration case, I want to talk a little bit about two things that have been mentioned in the news regarding this controversy. Todd Pettis, possibility of a recess appointment by the president?
It's legally possible, but as a political matter, it's not going to happen. The Supreme Court, in a recent case called Noel Canning, interpreted, you know, what the rules are. They kind of laid down what the rules are for recess appointments. And so long as the Senate, even when the Senate is not actively meeting, the senators are not in town, so long as the Senate every few days holds what we call a pro forma session, where technically the Senate is open for business even if there's no one there on the floor debating things, then there's not actually a recess that triggers the president's ability to fill an appointment.
The president – let me put this one to you, Tony. The president puts forward a nominee that gets blocked all the way. We get a new president. Does that president have to have the same nominee, or can that new president pick an entirely new nominee?
Oh, the next president will be free to nominate whoever they want to the Supreme Court. And we have encountered this in the past. The Abe Fortas nomination in the late 60s is an example. So whoever the next president is will have a whole lot of freedom to choose whomever they want to choose as their nominee to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Todd Pettis, what about the next session? These cases have already been chosen by justices, nine justices. If we continue, which looks like we very likely could have eight justices, will that impact the choice of the cases?
I think except for those who really follow the law closely, I think next term, you know, starting in October through spring of 2017 is likely to be a bit of a snoozer for people who follow the court. The justices are just not going to pack their docket with cases that they think they're likely to split 4-4 because it's largely a waste of everyone's time. I think they're going to fill their docket very lightly. We won't – probably not as many cases as usual. And they'll be largely cases that are important to the parties who are involved. They'll be important to attorneys, but they're not likely to dominate the headlines in the same way that, you know, abortion or birth control or immigration do.
Back to cases before the Supreme Court, significant cases that will definitely have a fallout, will have an impact on us in Iowa as others across the nation, depending on how they're decided. Tony, an immigration case, United States v. Texas. Tell us about that case.
That's right, Ben. United States v. Texas is a case that turns on federal immigration law. And a little background is important to understand the context of the case. As I'm sure your listener or your listeners know, there are somewhere between 11 and 12 million illegal or unauthorized immigrants in the United States today. And this is a problem that dates back to the 1980s when the last time Congress attempted to address this issue by implementing an immigration reform bill in 1986 that provided amnesty to about 3 million illegal immigrants or unauthorized immigrants. And that was a bipartisan measure. It was a Democratic Congress and a Republican president that agreed to it. But in the intervening years, we've continued to see people come into the United States either without authorization or people who came into the United States legally but then overstayed visas. And so now we're up to about 11.5 million people who have that status. And President Bush attempted to address this issue after his reelection in 2004, but the Republican Congress defeated his efforts. And that brings us to President Obama. He, as a Democrat, faced even more intense opposition to immigration reform when the Republican Congress came into power following the November 2010 elections. Therefore, the president in 2012 took executive action and in order to essentially provide a quasi-temporary legal status for about a million children who had either were brought into the country illegally by their parents or who were adults at the time of the 2012 enactment but were children at the time that they were first entered the United States or their parents overstayed their visas. And then in 2014, the president expanded the program to address about 4 million parents of American citizens, usually children who were born in the United States to a mother who had undocumented status. Well, the Republican Congress adamantly opposed what the president did and claimed that the president lacked authority to do this. Now, the president was acting through an executive order both in 2012 and 2014. And the president's goal was essentially to delay the deportation of these roughly 5 million people in order to give the president and Congress time to come up with a permanent solution to this problem. Mm-hmm. Well, the state of Texas and about 25 other states brought suit against the federal government, arguing that the president had violated federal law and had injured the states by not proceeding with the normal process of deporting these unauthorized immigrants. What's interesting is the district court in Texas issued an injunction blocking the president from implementing his executive order until a trial was held to actually resolve the underlying substantive legal issues. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the injunction that was issued by the district court. And so the issue that's before the Supreme Court right now really turns on the injunction that was issued to block implementation of the president's executive order.
Mm-hmm. And in the news, the people that you're talking about that Obama changed the law for, these are – we commonly call those or dreamers, right? These are what are referred to as dreamers?
At least with regard to the 2012 program, that's right. It's about a million children or now adults who came to the United States when they were children.
Mm-hmm. Could this case, depending on how it's decided, redefine sort of a balance of power between Congress and the president?
It could, and it potentially could redefine the relationship between the states and the executive branch in this sense. The battle here is between the Congress and the president, but the states are arguing that they have legal standing under Article 3 of the Constitution to sue the federal government for the way in which it enforces federal law, or in the viewpoint of the states, the way in which the federal government fails to enforce federal law. So that itself is actually a very important constitutional issue. And then there's a second big constitutional issue here, which developed in the case rather late, but it's quite important, and that is whether or not the president's executive orders violate the Take Care Clause of the Constitution, which essentially directs the president to take care that the laws that Congress enacts are faithfully executed. Mm-hmm. So there are some big issues tied up in this case, but as Todd indicated before with regard to the next term, the fact that we only have 8 justices on the Supreme Court right now will likely lead the court to try to find a procedural way out of this case without rendering a sweeping opinion that would have
procedural meaning they will be five at least agreeing on something that doesn't have very far-reaching effects, a very narrow reading.
That's right. I mean, one option for them, one of the issues before the court, is just whether the president complied with the technical requirements of something called the Administrative Procedures Act that basically says before the executive branch or an administrative agency issues an order or takes an action, it's got to provide a time period for notice and public comment. And the states are arguing that the president did not comply with the Administrative Procedures Act before issuing this order. That would be a way to at least kind of ironically buy time for the court to get a full complement of justices before hearing the other issues in this case.
If you just joined us, two professors of law on our program today, Tony Goggin of Drake University and Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa, going over some of the most significant cases before the high court, also how it's functioning, likely to function in the coming months. It will be an extended period. It looks like with 8 members, that even number is really the critical thing, because if there is a tie, it's the lower court decision that stands. Let's go on to a couple of other cases that you highlighted as ones that will be less influential due to Antonin Scalia's death. Fisher v. Texas. Was that Todd or Tony who wanted to tackle that? Was it you, Todd?
I'm happy to talk about Fisher. Just quickly in a nutshell, it has to do with racial preferences in higher education. Affirmative action. It's a follow-up to litigation that's gone on at other universities, University of Michigan, most prominent among them. Can a university take race into account when putting together its entering class? Justice Scalia, of course, not there. Justice Kagan, I believe, is recusing herself from this case. So it's possible. So we've got an odd number of justices. It's possible we could have a 4-3 ruling in this case, though I suspect that given the momentousness of the issue and how heavily it's been litigated, I'd be a little surprised if a majority wanted to purport to say something sweeping here where it's a 4-3 court, though there's no legal reason. There's nothing in the law that would prevent them from doing that if they wish to.
Mm-hmm. This had to do with a white female, Caucasian female, who objected to the fact that race was put in as a component to admission to a Texas university.
Right. Texas, the University of Texas takes most of its freshmen through what they call a top 10% program. There are students who have graduated in the top 10% of their Texas high school. The remaining 25%, a lot of factors are taken into account. Race is one of them, and she says, if that weren't the case, you would have taken me.
Okay. Implications here possibly for here in Iowa?
As a legal matter, yes. Public universities everywhere. I don't think it would change how the University of Iowa does business, as I understand their admissions practices.
Why would this be less affected by the 4-4 makeup of the court?
Well, because if Justice Kagan recuses herself, we're down now to 7 members, and so they can still form a majority of 7. But even the and so they're free to do that. They have the legal power to speak. But because it's 4-3, I wonder if there's something psychological kind of in, from the justices' point of view, that maybe it's not an ideally composed court to decide such a momentous issue for the nation.
Tony, let's have you move on to a few criminal cases before the high court on the docket this year. Tell us about them quickly and what they have in common.
Sure. There's a basically three cases have been consolidated before the Supreme Court, and they all involve blood alcohol tests or other variations of tests to identify whether or not a driver is driving under the influence of drugs or alcohol. And the cases have a basically common legal issue, which is in the absence of a warrant from a court, may a state make it a crime for a person to refuse to take a chemical test to detect either alcohol or drugs in the person's bloodstream? There are about 13 states in the country that do, in fact, make it a criminal offense to refuse to take a blood alcohol test or similar test. And the key point here is the lack of a warrant. In these states, even if the police do not have a warrant, if you refuse to take the test, you are guilty of a criminal offense that can involve jail time. And in some of the cases, you're also subject to a civil sanction, such as a suspension of your driver's license.
Is that the case here in Iowa? What is the – do you know?
I did not see Iowa listed on the states that are involved in this litigation, so I don't actually know whether or not Iowa is among them. But Minnesota and North Dakota are, so certainly two neighboring states
so
are.
So this would, depending on the outcome here, unify all the states in this way too about to the degree to which authorities can force breath analyzer blood tests.
That's right. Well, it would if the 13 states that currently make it a crime are ruled to be in violation of the Fourth Amendment prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures. It's not clear which way the court will rule because there are clearly some competing interests here. One big one is simply the fact that drunk driving is obviously a huge issue nationally. About 10,000 people die every year in drunk driving-related cases. And yet, on the other hand, there are obviously very serious Fourth Amendment concerns if the police, if you can be punished for refusing to agree to a warrantless search. And this is all really turning on a phrase that the Supreme Court has carved out in previous cases, which is that some searches are permissible, warrantless searches, when they are made, quote-unquote, incident to arrest. And the underlying fact pattern of all these cases that are before the court right now is that the drivers were arrested under the suspicion of drunk driving or driving under the influence. And the police want to be able to take a chemical test to confirm whether or not the person was driving under the influence by using an analogy, which is that the police are already allowed to do a search of the area immediately surrounding the arrested person in order to promote officer safety, the concern being that a person might have a weapon near them at the time of their arrest. So we allow police officers to conduct searches incident to arrest in order to promote officer safety and here's where the analogy would be strongest, in order to preserve evidence. And now that's obviously susceptible to a whole lot of different interpretations, but that's what the police are saying. They're saying, look, if we're not allowed to implement this blood test after arresting someone, their blood alcohol levels are going to fall quickly, and therefore we're going to lose evidence that would have been preserved if we were allowed to implement the test. But the catch is, 3 years ago in a Missouri case, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the police should try to get a warrant if possible before testing a suspected driver, a driver who's suspected of driving under the influence. Now, that Missouri case wasn't crystal clear, which is why we're back at the Supreme Court 3 years later. But it does seem to suggest that the court thinks that because blood alcohol levels don't fall so quickly, that an immediate search is always necessary to preserve evidence. So this is just a very interesting case and somewhat unpredictable regarding how the case will ultimately come out.
Okay. We have two more cases we'd like to have you tell us about before this hour ends, looking at some of the most significant cases before the U.S. Supreme Court with Tony Goggin and Todd Pettis. Tony, let me go to you and say, well, in the interest of fairness, that we get Todd over on talking about one more case. A couple minutes on this case that has to do with politics and the First Amendment, Heffernan and the City of Patterson.
Yes, this is a great case, Ben. Great case in that it's just very interesting. The issue before the court in Heffernan is whether the First Amendment bars the government from demoting a public employee based on the employee supervisor's perception that the employee supports a political candidate. Now, the U.S. Circuit Courts of Appeal, which is Todd talked about earlier, they're the intermediate federal appellate courts, they're split on whether the government may demote an employee in these circumstances when the supervisor is acting on a mistaken belief that the employee has some particular political belief.
Heffernan was picking up some yard signs, he said, for his mother, a political yard signs, right, in this case.
Exactly right. And the key point here simply was he was a police officer who was not eligible to vote in this mayoral election, but another police officer drove by and saw Heffernan picking up a yard sign for his mother, and the yard sign was a sign in support of a challenger to the incumbent mayor.
Okay.
And as a result, Heffernan was demoted from being a detective to being a patrol officer. And the key point before the court is, does it matter that Heffernan actually wasn't supporting the challenger? That's an issue that the court will have to resolve.
In just a few seconds, what effect could this decision have?
Well,
on free speech?
It's a big free speech case in that if the court supports the supervisor here, it really will open up. It could lead to a bunch of second and third order effects in that there could be a chilling effect on free speech because supervisors could use all kinds of justifications for demoting people now as long as the supervisor doesn't actually know what the person's beliefs are or is mistaken in those beliefs.
Okay, Todd Pettis. 2 minutes to tell us about a case before the high court, Evan Well v. Abbott, about voting.
Sure. I'll just give you kind of the teaser version of the case.
Okay.
If people are gripped by this, they can look it up. It's Evenwell with one L at the end, Evenwell versus Abbott. Abbott is Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas. One of the things that makes this case interesting is that here we have a voter, that's Sue Evenwell, suing the governor of Texas or the state of Texas, and the ACLU, the Democratic National Committee, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund are all coming to Texas's defense, arguing that Texas is doing the right thing. And it's conservative organizations like the Eagle Forum that are lining up behind Evenwell. So that tells you right there that, you know, we talked earlier about abortion restrictions in Texas and so forth. So these are not politics as we usually understand them. And just quickly in a nutshell, it has to do with how we count heads within a state when we're dividing up districts for representation in the state legislature. Districts have to have roughly equal population. When we say population, are we talking about total number of people, including children, convicted felons, and so forth, people who can't vote? Or are we grouping people only by whether they're eligible to vote? So it's a fight about what the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution requires when dividing people up into equal groups. Do we look at everybody there? Do we look just at registered voters? And people can guess from the politics with the NAACP, the DNC, ACLU, and so forth, which side Texas is taking.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there for time's sake. Todd Pettis and Tony Goggin, I'll leave you with this question. I guess you could choose to decline looking into the crystal ball. The big question is, how is this going to play out in the Supreme Court with a replacement for Antonin Scalia? Can you tell us, Tony, we're ending the show here, so will we go with eight justices way to at least March in 2017?
I think the only honest answer is I really don't know. At this point, we're in such uncharted terrain. I think it's extremely hard to make a prediction.
Okay, Todd Pettis, will you wage a prediction here?
Does it depend on – will you invite me back or not, depending on whether I take
Of course we will.
Yeah, you know, I don't
we
know.
We have plenty of political analysts who get it wrong all the time.
I don't know any more than your listeners do. It's going to be a very rare person who's going to get a confirmation. Okay, a very rare person. And is Brian Sandoval, governor of Nevada, one of those? I don't know, but it's a very rare person. Absent the choosing of such a person, we're going to be at eight for a long time.
Todd Pettis, professor of law at the H. Blair and Joan B. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law, Tony Goggin, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University. Tony, Todd, it's been a pleasure to have you on this hour. Thank you both.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on this program, it's a News Buzz edition of our program, and we'll talk about the politics of this decision to replace Antonin Scalia, and about specifically about Senator Grassley's predicament here and his statements. That's coming up on our News Buzz edition tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.